This is David Duke. And this is David Duke, and this is the David Duke Internet Web Radio broadcast, broadcasting to the entire world with news and information of vital importance to Europeans and people of European descent, no matter where they may live on the earth. And certainly this broadcast is important for all people, because I believe in the preservation of all races, all cultures, all faiths, all nations. I don't think that any nation should dictate to another. I don't believe in any form of racial supremacy, whether it be Jewish supremacy, white supremacy, black supremacy, yellow supremacy. But I do believe every people, every race, has a right to exist, to have a society that reflects their own values, their own desires, their own culture, their own traditions, their own faith, where they feel comfortable, in a nation where they feel at home. That is changing for the people of Europe. There are 1.3 billion Chinese, and China is all Chinese. There are over a billion Africans, and Africa is practically all African. South American nations are brown nations to a great extent. And in Europe and America, we have massive immigration, which will literally wipe away our traditions and our values. I don't believe it is hatred to want to defend your culture, your traditions, your heritage. I don't think it's hatred to want your children to look something like you and those who came before you. I am not a supremacist, and I oppose any sort of violence or terrorism or radicalism, whether it be from Jewish sources or other radical Muslim sources or radical Jewish sources. I believe in equal rights for all, and I also believe in the preservation of all. I'm opposed to colonialism. I'm opposed to globalism. I believe in those principles. I believe in human rights. I believe in freedom of speech and freedom of press, freedom of conscience, and freedom of thought. Now, today I'm broadcasting to you from Eastern Europe, and I want to tell you about a recent incident that occurred to me and around me. And I also am going to, in this broadcast, continue on with my audiobook version of Jewish supremacism. And today we're in the middle of the chapter on Israel, a terrorist state, a chapter that exposes the fact that the nation most guilty of terrorism, treachery, violation of human rights on the planet is in fact the nation of Israel, a fact that's pretty much covered up by so much of the world press. Well, that's not hard to understand when you understand who dominates the press, both in America and a lot of the press in Europe. However, there seems to be more freedom of the press in Europe. Well, ladies and gentlemen, for years, in fact, I posted a picture on my site of climbing in the Alps. I've gone to the Alps for many years when I had the chance for a day or two to climb a mountain, to soak in the sun, to soak in some good air in the higher elevations, and to contemplate life, to contemplate my beliefs, my values, and my visions. I don't go to these places. I go to often Upper Austria, I go to Germany, I go to Switzerland, I go to Northern Italy. I don't go to these places to rabble rouse. I don't go to speak at meetings. I don't go to cause any revolutionary activity. Sometimes in these areas, I often visit with academics, professors of many different disciplines, who've requested a conversation, an interview with me, because I'm a well-known American politician. I ran a presidential primary as I came very close to the U.S. Senate, and probably one of the most, I guess one of the better-known American politicians because of my views. One of the few Americans who have dared to oppose Zionism and the State of Israel, and really the grip that the Zionists have on so much of the American media and government. Many academics talk to me because of my positions in opposition to the Iraq War. I came out long before the war began. I explained to my constituents and the world that Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction, and I gave my reasons. I said that Iraq had no alliance with al-Qaeda, which it didn't. And I said that the war was not a war for oil. It was not a war for American imperialism. It was only and purely a war for the Jewish agenda, as outlined by the paper by Pearl and many other Jewish neocons called A Clean Break, A Strategy for Securing the Realm, which was written for Benjamin Netanyahu and the Israeli government, where they advocated war with Iraq, war with Syria, war with Lebanon, war with Iran. So I've had many academics around the world who requested my presence. Sometimes I've talked to them. Frequently I've had a chance to talk with some of their students. And it's been a good and rewarding experience for me. It's not something I get any money from. They don't pay me to come see them. But it's very important to get the information out about the on these issues. And when I'm near the Alps and near some beautiful areas, I love to do a little climbing, a little hiking in the mountains. In fact, I posted a picture of a little climb I made recently. Well, I was recently in an area of Upper Austria. I'm not going to say exactly where, and I won't identify any names. But I've met some people casually, and we decided to go climb in the mountains. They called a friend, and we had a group, and we climbed some in the mountains, and we had a very nice time. Climbed very high, and I tell you, I was very sore after that last climb. And in the course of the day, people ask me what I do, and they ask about my PhD in history and what I teach and what I talk about. And we discussed a little bit of the issues. I discussed some of the aspects of the Israeli control of American foreign policy, about the eras of Zionism. I even discussed the fact that I was concerned about the preservation of the culture of Germany, the culture of Austria, the culture of Switzerland, the culture of Italy, the people of those lands who are literally being ethnically cleansed in a way by this massive immigration. Because if the immigration continues, they will lose their heritage. And I said, I don't think this is a good thing. I think that all people have a right to live and a right to be preserved in their culture and their heritage. Now, this was all in a private conversation. And there was basic agreement by all parties. Expressed that way, no one is going to object to those principles. Of course, that's not the way the anti-immigration position is expressed by the media. And that's not the way the media wants it expressed by the media. One of the individuals was a little confused, and they said, well, this information is kind of too much for me. And basically, she later told her brother, who was not part of the conversation, and the brother then, believe it or not, called what's called the Constitutional Police. That's right, the Constitutional Police. And that's a similar type of situation to what they had, you know, the defenders of the revolution in France, the committees that used to put people on the guillotine. It's similar to what happened, you know, in Russia, the defenders of the revolution, these the police of the revolution and so forth. And their purpose is to stifle and suppress any sort of controversial idea that may threaten, quote, the Constitution. Well, I'm not threatening any Constitution. I'm threatening no peace and civility. In fact, I've always said, and I've always been anti-violent, and I've always been, I think, a strong influence on the anti-immigration forces in the fact that I've always said that any sort of violence is not only morally wrong, but it's counterproductive to our cause, that it will only hurt the things we believe in. So truly, I think I've always been a force for decency, for legality, for nonviolence, and for constitutional actions in defense of our heritage and our values. But simply getting in a conversation caused the brother of one of these individuals to literally call the Constitutional Police and report his sister. Now, that's kind of amazing, isn't it, ladies and gentlemen? Isn't that amazing? I mean, you've always heard the story. I think you probably heard it before. And it's a fact. In fact, there were statues built to this individual. In Ukraine, during the terrible famines, where 7 to 9 million people were literally murdered in the great famines of the Stalin years of the Soviet control over Ukraine, they had a policy where the peasants could not raise any grain. The farmers could not keep any chickens, any eggs, any products of their toil to feed themselves and their families. And they literally starved. In fact, the figures range between 7 and 11 million people starved in Ukraine, about a quarter of the population, in fact. And this is a fact of history. It's one of those terrible genocides that's never talked about or very seldom talked about in the media. There's no movies and no violins that are played for the victims of this horrible genocide. Well, one of the rules and one of the things the communist regime tried to instill into their people was that you had to turn in your friends or family members who were counter-revolutionary. And there were some peasants, a mother and father, who kept a little grain aside so they could feed themselves and their child. And their son turned in their parents as counter-revolutionaries. And eventually, these parents suffered greatly, of course, and the uncle of the young person was so incensed that he literally killed the kid for doing this, which nobody defends that act. I mean, a kid's a kid, but the point is that, you know, in fact, the government then built statues and made this kid a hero of the revolution for turning in your parents. All of us have talked about that and heard about those ideas. In fact, that's one of the allegations against the National Socialists in Germany, where they tell you to turn in their parents and things like this, that the idea of turning in your parents to the state or your loved ones, your relatives, if they think forbidden thoughts, if they commit any thought crimes. And here was a case of an individual, a brother, that turned in his own relation because of this individual who he thought had these terribly dangerous thoughts. And the Constitutional Police, interestingly enough, called him back after researching it, and they said, well, we don't see any problem with David Duke in the sense that he's not dangerous. We have our eye on him, and he hasn't broken any laws yet. And as long as he doesn't break any laws, he can do what he wants, and he travels frequently all over Europe, and you know, he can go to the mountains or do whatever he wants to do. So that was one good thing, in fact, that they did say that to the individual. But the next thing you know, these constitutional police are now visiting these individuals. Now, these aren't people who are political. These are just individuals who work, have normal lives in Austria. They went to the work of one of the individuals and interviewed the person. I mean, it's just incredible. And no one wants to deal with that kind of issue. I mean, no one wants that kind of hassle. I mean, it's just really an incredible situation, and it's a sad situation, but it's showing you where we're going in the world in terms of freedom and justice. It's just incredible. And someone who would turn in their cause problems for their family member because they had conversations with a politically incorrect individual, that's not freedom, ladies and gentlemen. And in that part of the world, I don't do any political work per se. Again, I've had some private conversations, and most of the people that I know that I've been talked to are totally non-political, just private conversations and having fun, climbing in the mountains and drinking a couple of good German beers. But this is the kind of thing that goes on in this new thought police type of society we live in. And I really don't think, and I don't blame the Constitutional Police that much for what they do. I mean, they just do their job, and they're paid for their job. They might not even agree with the policies that are set by the government. But I do blame the policies that are being set by the government that would try to stifle freedom of speech and thought and expression. You know, one thing the brother of the individual said, which was very revealing, he said that David Duke, he's a very dangerous person. He's got such dangerous ideas. And as I explained to my friends, there are no dangerous ideas. The danger comes when we suppress ideas that we think are dangerous. We have got to debate issues, to think about issues, to question dogma. And the idea that you can't even question aspects of historical periods, that you can't have certain opinions on certain things, this is not a matter of science. This is a matter of religion, and a very dogmatic and a bigoted religion. You can't even question. If you question an idea, or you go against the prevailing thought, or the official thought, or the media thought, then you're suddenly a thought criminal. And as I mentioned before, like David Irving, I mean, he's sitting in prison for 3 years for statements he made in 1989 about an historical event over 50 years old. you know, this is really a matter of faith. If you even question any aspect of certain aspects of history, then you're actually breaking the law in some countries. Just a question. You know, if you don't have the faith, if you don't have the one true faith, it sounds like religious dogma to me, doesn't it? To you, it sounds like the Inquisition to me. But that's just a little story I have to show you what's going on, that people are so acclimatized today, and they're so fearful, and they're so propagandized. And here's an individual that would call and cause problems for his flesh and blood, his own family, because he thinks that someone's got dangerous ideas, and somehow this person shouldn't be allowed to express himself. He shouldn't be allowed freedom of speech or travel or movement. All principles, by the way, that are outlined in the United Nations Convention and also outlined in the European Convention and in most constitutions of most governments. The idea of freedom of travel, freedom of speech, freedom of thought, freedom of conscience. And that's where we're going to in the world, and yet I'm called the repressor, and I'm called the terrible person who wants to deny people of their human rights. And the truth is, I don't want to deny anyone of their rights at all. I believe in freedom of speech and freedom of press and freedom of thought and freedom of conscience. And I have never before in my life, and I wouldn't, try to suppress ideas and thoughts. I might want to debate. In fact, I've always been willing to debate the opposition. Let's debate these ideas freely and openly and fairly. And right now, I just read recently in the paper that the president of Iran has challenged Bush to a debate. Isn't that a heck of a lot better way to deal with international problems than to go to war and cost tens of thousands of lives and billions of dollars and God knows how many trillions of dollars harm to the world economy if we go to war against Iran? Let's debate the issues so the people in America can hear the president of Iran's true thoughts and ideas, and they can hear President Bush's thoughts and ideas. Of course, Bush will never debate. He can't debate because he can only lose such a debate, because this war is being driven on by Israeli interests. All the president of Iran has to mention is that, why do we have a special standard for Israel? Why does Israel have nuclear weapons and biological weapons and chemical weapons? Why is Israel allowed to invade other countries and violate United Nations regulations? And by the way, according to American law, we are not supposed to our treaties. We are not supposed to supply or support any nation that violates United Nations sanctions, United Nations resolutions. And of course, Israel has been violating one of the main United Nations resolutions passed by the Security Council, which we voted for over 35 years ago, about Israel vacating the West Bank and Gaza. Well, they vacated Gaza to a degree. Now they've got one big concentration camp called Gaza. But they still occupy much of the West Bank. And by law, America shouldn't be giving Israel one penny, and yet we have this kind of policy going on. People always bring up my past, and they talk about, well, the fact that years ago I was in a KKK group, but they don't mention the fact, and don't talk about the fact, that my group was a legal group. Not one member of my organization was ever charged with any crime against any minorities or any individual, any violence whatsoever, not one. They think of the Klan as some huge organization, and the truth is that there are many different organizations with separate leadership, separate constitutions, and they have this image which is totally false. And of course, since that time, and I guess my past there is a legitimate point of view, but it's not the only point of view. So I mean, since that time, I've started successful organizations. I've got elected to office twice in free elections in the state of Louisiana. I came very close to the United States Senate and governorship of my state, where I got 65% of the European American vote, 60 and 65% of the European American vote in major elections, and in elections with as many people in the electorate as, say, Switzerland. it's just amazing the support that I received there. And of course, since that time, I've gone on to get my PhD, and I've gone on to teach and lecture, and yet the only thing they talk about is former Ku Klux Klansmen, and it's really a biased situation. They don't use that prefix in front of Robert Byrd, but it's because they don't really fear Robert Byrd. What they do this to me, not because of what I say today. They do this because, what I said back then, or the members, the groups I was involved with back then, but they do it because of what I believe today, because they're afraid of the ideas and principles I represent, and that's why they must use these ad hominem attacks and these other kinds of smearing attacks against me. Former Black Panthers, there's all kinds of members of the parliament in many European countries and many nations who were former communists or radical communists. And, of course, communism was the greatest killing machine in the face of the earth. They killed more people by far than the Nazis ever thought about killing. And yet they don't say former communist. They just simply say the man's name or the position he had. They don't identify me as David Duke, former member of the House of Representatives from Louisiana. They always put the pejorative terms on my head. David Duke, anti-Semitic, or David Duke, white supremacist. Neither of which I am. I don't consider myself anti-Semitic. I'm not opposed to all Jews, but I am opposed to Jewish extremism. And that's one of the things that my book explains. My book, Jewish Supremacism, is in fact dedicated to a Jew himself. How do you call that? How is a book anti-Semitic when you quote all the way through your book from prominent Jews who oppose Zionism? You praise Jews who defend the Jewish people from the machinations of the Zionists. And you don't advocate any sort of repression of people, but you advocate fairness, justice, and decency to all people. But that's just not the way it works today, ladies and gentlemen, just the same way we get a distorted image of Lebanon. Well, let me complete and let me give you another segment of my book now. And it's really been good to be with you today and share with you some of these thoughts and ideas. We're going into, this is, of course, Israel 2, Supremacism Through Terror. And this is from my book, Jewish Supremacism. And we just finished talking about the terrible violation of America that existed in Lebanon. For instance, I just discussed the fact that Ostrovsky, who is one of the Mossad agents of Israel, revealed in his book that the Mossad had information that dealt with U.S. Presence in Lebanon, had detailed intelligence that may have, quote, averted the 1983 suicide bombing of the Marine barracks in Beirut that killed 241 U.S. servicemen. But Israel purposely did not share it. They wanted this kind of thing to happen. And I believe the same thing happened many years later. History does repeat itself in terms of 9/11. There's lots of evidence that Israel had advanced knowledge of 9/11, but they wanted 9/11 to accomplish their strategic aims. Now, that may sound pretty radical to a lot of people listening, but don't forget the Levant affair. The Jewish state sent terrorists to blow up American installations and blame it on the Egyptians. I mean, that was a great act of terrorism and treachery. And, of course, in 67, they attacked the USS Liberty. But anyway, let me continue on, and we're going to talk about Jewish terrorism, and we're talking about the extremist terrorism of Israel, the Qana massacre. And interestingly enough, there was another massacre, of course, in the last few weeks at Qana, by Israel, in the same town where this original massacre I'll talk about today occurred, where 36 children were murdered by the Israeli forces. And here it goes, and this is from my book, Jewish Supremacism. Our more recent massacre was at Qana, a small town in southern Lebanon. Here are some excerpts of a British journalist's eyewitness account of the action so that the reader can fully understand that behind the cold statistics are real people. People who have faced a horror no less real than those who were murdered in the World Trade Center bombing. And this is a quotation directly from Robert Fisk, his article for the London Independent. Qana, southern Lebanon, it was a massacre. Not since Sabra and Shatila had I seen the innocent slaughtered like this. The Lebanese refugee women and children and men lay in heaps, their hands or arms or legs missing, beheaded or disemboweled. There were well over 100 of them. A baby lay without a head. The Israeli shells had scythed through them as they lay in the United Nations shelter, believing that they were safe under the world's protection. Like the Muslims of Srebrenica, the Muslims of Qana were wrong. In front of a building burning of the UN's Fijian battalion headquarters, a girl held a corpse in her arms, the body of a gray-haired man whose eyes were staring at her as she rocked the corpse back and forth in her arms, keening and weeping and crying the same words over and over, "My father, my father." A Fijian United Nations soldier stood amid a sea of bodies and, without saying a word, held aloft the body of a headless child. When I walked toward them, I slipped on a human hand. Israel's slaughter of civilians in this terrible 10-day offensive, 206 by last night, has been so cavalier, so ferocious, that not a Lebanese will forgive this massacre. There had been the ambulance attacked on Saturday, the sisters killed in Yamour the day before, the 2-year-old girl decapitated by an Israeli missile 4 days ago, and earlier yesterday the Israelis had slaughtered a family of 12. The youngest was a 4-day-old baby when Israeli helicopter pilots fired missiles into their home. Shortly afterwards, 3 Israeli jets dropped bombs only 250 meters from a United Nations convoy on which I was traveling, blasting a house 30 feet into the air in front of my eyes. Traveling back to Beirut to file my report on the Khanna massacre to the Independent last night, I found 2 Israeli gunboats firing at the civilian cars on the river bridge north of Sidon. A French UN trooper muttered oaths to himself as he opened a bag in which he was dropping feet, fingers, pieces of people's arms. We had suddenly become not UN troops and journalists, but Westerners, Israelis, allies, an object of hatred and venom. One bearded man with fierce eyes stared at us, his face dark with fury. "You are Americans," he screamed at us. "Americans are dogs. You did this. Americans are dogs." President Bill Clinton has allied himself with Israel in its war against, quote, terrorism in the Lebanese. In their grief, had not forgotten this. Israel's official expression of sorrow was rubbing salt in their wounds. Quote, "I would like to be made into a bomb and blow myself up amid the Israelis," one old man said. Unquote. Unlike the bloody scenes of the aftermath of Palestinian suicide bombers in Israel, Americans and Europeans never saw the butchery that Fisk describes. The media very seldom draw our attention to sufferings inflicted by Jews. It is suffering inflicted on Jews that they focus on. Those who wear the six-pointed star and who bomb United Nations shelters, ambulances, civilian refugee camps, and civilian automobiles are never described as terrorists. They are simply referred to as commandos or simply military forces. In contrast, Palestinian fighters outside the borders of Israel are, of course, routinely described as terrorists. And as a side note, of course, this is how Hezbollah got its start, from the incredible terrorism and violence and murder of the Israeli invasion of Lebanon. Now, the remarks of the old man at Khanna that he would like to be made into a bomb and blow himself up amid the Israelis proved tragically prophetic. For just a year and a half later, a number of Palestinians, desperate to exact revenge, sacrificed their lives to do just that in Jerusalem marketplaces. Since that time, dozens have done so in intervening years. No one can defend any acts that kill or maim the innocent, but it's important to understand the horror that has induced hundreds of Palestinians to sacrifice their own lives to strike their feeble blows at those who have murdered their loved ones and stolen their homeland. In their grief and rage, they also commit acts of violence against the innocent. The Zionist leaders also know full well that such Jewish losses, stroked relentlessly by the media, airing the blood-splashed videos around the world, only increases Jewish solidarity and augments non-Jewish sympathy for the eternally suffering Jewish people. When Saddam Hussein tried to take back Kuwait, which had once been part of Iraq, the Western world went to war, encouraged to do so, most notably by Israel. Were Iraq's actions any more imperialistic than Israel's against the Palestinians or against the Lebanese? Israel still occupies the West Bank, and they still imprison Gaza. They occupy part of the Golan Heights in violation of United Nations resolutions, which have also been approved by the United States of America. Other than the scale of the conflict, what is the difference between Israel's perpetual wars of conquest compared to Nazi Germany seeking Lebensraum in the 1940s. Germany treated no nations any worse than Israel did Palestine, with its terrorizing and driving out three-fourths of its Palestinian residents. No populations of any European nation other than those in some of the Soviet-occupied sectors of Germany had been so massively displaced. It is interesting to note that Jews also directed the terror against the Germans as well, but in that war, they wore the uniform of the Soviet commissars rather than that of the terrorist Stern Gang or Haganah. Within the borders of Israel and our occupied territories, under the heel of a harsh military occupation, Israel continues to expropriate land from the Palestinians, settlement by settlement. Naturally, the Palestinians resist such confiscation. The greatest uprising in recent years was the Intifada. The statistics of Palestinian casualties are ominous. Here are the figures compiled by the major French magazine Le Monde. 1,116 Palestinians have been killed since the beginning of the Intifada, stone-throwing revolt, on 9 December 1987, shot by soldiers, policemen, or settlers. The figures break down as follows. 626 deaths in 1988 and 89, 134 in 1990, 93 in 1991, 108 in 1992, 155 from January 1st to September 11, 1993. Among the victims were 233 children under 17 years old, according to a study carried out by B'Tselem, the Israeli Association for Human Rights. Military sources give the figure of nearly 20,000 for the number of Palestinians wounded by bullets. And the UN Relief and Works Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, gives the figure of 90,000. This humanitarian organization also indicates that at least 20,000 detainees are tortured every year during interrogation in the military detention centers. Unquote. No country in peacetime, not even the Soviets or the Red Chinese in the heyday of their gulags, has held as many prisoners per capita as the nation of Israel. It's one of the few nations that will not officially renounce the use of torture. It has long been high on the list of the offenders compiled by Amnesty International. The London Times magazine did an extensive exposé on Israeli torture in the 1970s, the 1980s, and 1990s. The inescapable fact is that Israel was born and built by invasion, murder, and theft, and such injustice requires the use of force and terror to maintain its power. Since 1948, Palestinians have faced ongoing terrorism from Israel. Hundreds of villages have been obliterated and literally wiped from the map. Tens of thousands of homes have been bombed, bulldozed, or dynamited during peacetime. Tens of thousands of men, women, and children have been killed. Even greater numbers have been blinded, crippled, disfigured, and maimed. Hundreds of thousands have been imprisoned and/or tortured. In going after Palestinian resistance to Israeli occupation, Israel has never been shy about bombing refugee camps full of women and children. Israeli tanks, helicopters, even jet fighters are used to drop bombs or foul missiles into the heart of Palestinian neighborhoods and refugee camps packed with women and children. These weapons cannot discriminate between a supposed terrorist and an 8-year-old little girl. Such a weapon kills children as surely as it kills enemies of the state. Palestinians suspected of actively opposing Israel's occupation of the West Bank or Gaza have had their homes and families attacked by Israeli tank cannons, missiles, or bombs, and after their suspect is killed or imprisoned, the Israeli army bulldozers or dynamites their families' homes. Thousands of homes have been destroyed in this fashion. Israel has also killed hundreds of Palestinian leaders by assassination and terroristic attacks. These attacks often kill innocent bystanders. Many of those assassinated have never been associated with any terror or violence of any kind. They simply were poets, writers, or clerics who by their words have inspired in their countrymen the desire for freedom. The Israeli Prime Minister previous to Ariel Sharon was Ehud Barak. In 1972, during peacetime between Israel and Lebanon, he led an Israeli commando death squad into Beirut, Lebanon, where he personally murdered a Palestinian writer, Kamal Adwan. In the middle of the night, using silenced machine guns, he and his team slaughtered Adwan. The newly elected Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak came to New York and Washington. The Jewish-controlled press treated this murderer as a conquering hero. The double standards never seemed to end. When an Israeli cabinet official, Rekfam Zevi, was assassinated by Palestinians in October of 2001, Sharon and some of his U.S. officials denounced it as, quote, terrorism. If the shooting down of Zevi is indeed terrorism, what should we call many years of Israeli assassinations of hundreds of Palestinian political figures, philosophers, clerics, and poets? Why doesn't the press point out that Zevi himself was a Jewish supremacist who described Palestinians living and working illegally in Israel as, quote, lice and a cancer in our midst? Zevi himself obviously was an extreme Jewish supremacist and terrorist who advocated the forcible expulsion of all Palestinians from the occupied territories and the assassination of all those who resist Israeli occupation. He even publicly called for the assassination of Yasser Arafat. Yet the same press that called Zevi's assassination terrorism never called the pro-assassination Zevi a terrorist or even a Jewish supremacist. The Zevi assassination itself was in direct response to the Israeli assassination of a Palestinian leader a few weeks before. In 1991, at an Israeli cabinet meeting, Zevi said that President George Bush, by pressing Israel to peace talks, was, quote, an enemy of Israel, and that, quote, America was plotting a second Holocaust. With a supposed ally like this, does America need any enemies? The overwhelming power of the Jewish partisans in the world media keeps many people from fully grasping the terror of hundreds of Israeli assassinations. In fact, even before the World Trade Center terror attack in September, the BBC instructed their reporters to call Israel's assassination of their enemies, quote, targeted killings, rather than exactly what they were, assassinations. However, the BBC, which has a disproportionately Jewish executive staff, refer to the Zevi killing as an assassination and not as a, quote, targeted killing. The public has been subjected to this kind of sanitized and distorted media treatment of Israel for years. It's no wonder why few Britons and even fewer Americans are fully aware of Israel's record of terrorism. It is for this reason that I cannot blame most Americans for their ignorance of Israeli terrorism. And this section is at least 150,000 Palestinians tortured in Israel. The brutal torture of thousands of one's enemies must be classified as a particularly vicious form of terrorism. Tens of thousands of Palestinians have been tortured in Israeli jails. A Jewish human rights group in Israel confirmed in a 60-page report that 85% of Palestinian detainees undergo torture while in custody. And make no mistake about it, many of these tortures endured by these Palestinian victims are the stuff of one's worst nightmares. Israeli torture includes everything from choking victims with urine and feces-soaked bags tied over their heads to using electric cattle prods for anal rape and mutilation. Israel often doesn't even admit who they are holding, so if they decide to kill or torture a Palestinian to death while he's in custody, his body will simply disappear. They will later claim that they died in a battle with Israeli police before capture. Many thousands of Palestinians and Lebanese have died while in Israeli custody. A feature article by Joel Greenberg in the very pro-Israel New York Times stated matter-of-factly that Israel tortures 500 to 600 Palestinians every month. That figure, which is probably too low as it comes from the pro-Israel New York Times, means that each year at least 6,000 Palestinians are tortured in Israel. Torture of Palestinians has been going on in Israel since 1948. Even if one uses just one half of the number of Palestinians that Mr. Greenberg says suffer torture each year, at least 150,000 human beings have been tortured in Israeli jails since the founding of the Israeli state, and likely the numbers are a lot higher. Bowing to Israel's public relations problems because of its legalized torture, in 1999, the Israeli Supreme Court made an intentionally vague ruling that torture is sometimes illegal. But both Israeli and Palestinian rights groups offer much evidence that the ruling is just a public relations veneer. They offer evidence that torture continues with the same frequency and brutality as it did before the ruling. Following Israel's lead, Jewish journalists are now beginning to advocate the use of torture in America. A recent issue of Newsweek headlined an article entitled, Time to Think About Torture. It's a new world, and survival may well require old techniques that seemed out of the question, unquote. Even a supposed Jewish champion of civil liberties, Alan Dershowitz, now advocates torture. Victor Ostrovsky, a former Israeli Mossad agent, wrote two books about Israel's terror against their enemies. In one of them, he discusses the fate of Palestinians who illegally cross the border in search of work in Israel. Many thousands of these young men simply are never heard from again after being captured by Israeli forces. Some of them are taken to the ABC research facilities where they endure the indescribable horror of chemical, nuclear, or biological weapons testing. And here's a direct quote from Victor Ostrowski, former Mossad agent. ABC, standing for Atomic, Bacterial, and Chemical, it was where our top epidemiological scientists were developing various doomsday machines. Should there be an all-out war in which this type of weapon would be needed, there was no room for error. The Palestinian infiltrators came in handy in this regard. As human guinea pigs, they could make sure the weapons the scientists were developing worked properly and could verify how fast they worked and make them more efficient. And tomorrow I will cover Israeli weapons of terror, and we'll talk about how they even use the United States to invoke terror, as we did in terms of the sanctions of Iraq. I have a quotation in this next part of Madeleine Albright, our former Secretary of State, with Leslie Stahl, talking about how that the death of 500,000 Iraqi children was worth it to try to harm the government of Saddam Hussein. 500,000 children dying because of sanctions. And we'll go on with that tomorrow, and we're also going to talk about the ethnic bomb that was reported by Israeli journalists that Israel's trying to develop that it will attack non-Jews. That's right, an ethnic virus, an ethnic coded virus. And this was reported in major papers. And again, all my documentation can be found in the pages of my book, Jewish Supremacism, which is available for you from this website. Thanks so much for being with me. Please be sure to spread this word all over your neighborhood, your city, your state, your nation, and this world. These are important, important issues that are going to affect not only millions of people in the Middle East, but they're going to affect your family. The amount of money that you have in your pocket by what you spend for gasoline, or what's going to happen with the world economy, and maybe even the lives of yourself or your sons or your daughters, if they're sent to these foreign wars that are being fought not for America but for Israel. Thanks so much for being with me. I'll be looking forward to being with you again tomorrow. Bye bye now.
This has been a David Duke Worldwide Web Radio broadcast. For more information and to support our vital work, please visit www.daviddude.com.